You are listening to Radio Albion.
Everybody, welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 21st of June 2023. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And it shouldn't come as a shock to anybody that we're going to talk about nationalism today. I have to tell you that I have finished the 1600 pages of E. Michael Jones' Barren Metal. It is a tour de force as far as not just economic theory, but political theory. So many of these things, of course, I've been saying for many years. E. Michael Jones is not only a personal friend, but one of, if not the greatest influence on me intellectually. And he is one of the first real competent writers writing today to put out the a very, very coherent concept of the ethnic group as a political, not the state necessarily, but the ethno as the foundation of nationhood. Of course, that's been going, you know, that's very old. But as far as a contemporary understanding of how that works over time, and especially in American history and how the Catholic ethnicities frightened the WASP and Jewish elite. So, and he deals with, in this book, ultimately, it is an affirmation of natural law teaching. It explains U3 in tremendous historical detail. And as I've said in last month, I guess it was, that U3 and Rents are very similar in terms of the illegitimacy of gain. It revolves around magic, which in its primitive form gives some kind of an explanation as to how people can become wealthy without working. You see it in Dr. Faustus. You see it. You see it all over the place. This is really what magic comes down to. Alchemy, the fact that Isaac Newton and Adam Smith were alchemists and spoke about it in person. The concept of alchemy, in addition to what I've said in the past about it really being about people, it's really about the development of the gold standard. And this very lengthy book is a very long critique of the gold standard. In fact, I have changed my opinion about it. I was kind of gold-oriented when this came up, only because of the basic stability. It forbade governments from overstepping their bounds in a lot of different ways. I didn't realize, though, in terms of how it functions, who it truly benefits. And very briefly, it's a simple way to explain this. Because gold is a fixed foundation of value. The mining of gold is not a quick process. Generally speaking, it's going to be the same amount, which is a problem when production increases. So it becomes more of a problem when it's developed in the modern world. To become a debtor nation would be to have your gold essentially be owned by someone else, because especially several hundred years ago, it was the international currency. And the standard was how nations traded. When labor productivity goes up, there isn't the money to follow all of this. Prices go down. Essentially, it's a deflationary system. which means that workers are producing things, and they're working harder and they're working better, and yet the price, the worth of what they're putting out goes down. Deflation is a far worse entity than inflation, at least in part because you have to keep rates high. When you keep rates high and people are not being paid, you know, what their worth keeps going down because the price of their labor is going down, they have to borrow at rates that are usually very high because of the lack of money and this almost superstitious concept of that gold somehow is the same thing as wealth. And what this book teaches us, of course, is what we've all known. Wealth comes from labor. The Jewish idea versus a natural idea. Jewish idea is that you don't have to work. Have your money work for you and other stupid things. Well, it has to be based on something, and it's based on the labor of others. And living off of that is where the sin comes in. It comes down to risk. A usurer has a claim on your property if you default, therefore he has no risk. But that's not the same thing as if the lender were to be your partner in building productive capital. Then he is risking something. You're both risking it together. Insurance isn't a problem. But to make money twice, to eliminate risk, except for the person who, of course, you're lending to. And I don't have to talk about TARP and bailouts, but that's what rents, that's what modern capitalism is. And so Jones separates the economic world between usury and labor. Living by magical means, gold begetting gold, you don't have to do anything. The state, of course, is always right behind you. The British Navy and the American Navy is out there enforcing contracts. Again, removing all risk. And of course, most people couldn't follow a lot of these arguments. And, you know, of course, the other option is labor, producing things. So I want to talk about a nationalist writer, an eccentric nationalist writer that I've been writing, I've been speaking and writing for quite some time, studying since I first started grad school in, 30 years ago. And that's Johann Fichte. Before I do that, I have to give a very summary conception of Immanuel Kant and the one big thing he's known for. When I was in grad school, I had to take two doctoral courses on Immanuel Kant, one for the metaphysics and the other for the ethics. And Jones sees him as the means whereby the German nation, which was mobilized even by the defeat of Napoleon, defeat at the hands of Napoleon, as the organized force against British gold standard liberal imperialism. You know, Russia has that role today, and that British Newtonianism and utilitarianism was challenged by Germany and challenged by what came after Kant, essentially from Kant to Hegel. The epistemology is just, let me summarize it briefly. There's two kinds of statements, analytic and synthetic. Analytic statements are essentially tautological. You know, all bachelors are male. All bachelors are unmarried. The concept of the bachelor has both male and unmarried already in it. So it's a tautology. It has to be true just by the very use of those words. And synthetic is an empirical proposition. All liberals are pretentious. Well, there's nothing about inherently about liberals that make them pretentious. There's no conceptual identity there. It's something that you're going to have to demonstrate empirically. And because they're synthetic, they're not really logical. You have to build an inductive case. Kant made the argument that there's something else. There's synthetic a priori statements. They are universally true, just like analytic statements are. But they're not, it's not a tautology. And as an example there, he uses geometry. There's nothing inherent in these, in the shapes that we come across every day that is absolutely universal. It seems to be empirical. We come across this every minute of our lives. And yet, whether or not we recognize it, the truths of geometry are absolutely universal and yet manifest in empirical form. And that's the foundation of Kant's metaphysics, because he has to give account of this. He has to explain how that could possibly be. The truth of geometry are absolutely universal, despite the fact that they seem to be something we just come across day to day. How can that possibly be? And from there, he argues that the concept of space, and he adds time later, the concept of space isn't something that that we can perceive. It's implied in these geometric truths. It's something that is not out there, so to speak. We provide it. And because it's already in the mind, now this is not subjectivism, because these are universal truths, it's thought that conditions perception, not the other way around. Geometric truths can be synthetic and universally true, because the concept of space is something we impose on the world around us, space and time. And it's important to know this. Now, of course, that was very quick and always difficult to do that with someone like Kant. But that was the argument that, according to so many, myself included, so many others, destroyed or began the destruction, especially the German destruction, of the Newtonian utilitarian Adam Smith style universe that usury and capitalism, especially in Britain and Holland, was imposing on the world. And of course, you know, gold is one of the ways that this was done. Every once in a while, a nationalist will bring up people like Fichte. I always stressed Herder and then, of course, Hegel. And these are all roughly in a very similar period of time. And Jones brings up a point in a book that I hadn't read in a very long time, The Closed Commercial State. The thing about Fichte is that he went the next step beyond Kant. It was the self, it was the ego, that projected not only space and time, but everything else. The self versus the not-self. So he took, in German idealism comes from Kant, Fichte took it one step farther, and of course he had to be corrected later on, that everything comes from the ego. That doesn't mean it's purely subjective, because he became a nationalist partially because of this. Also because of this point of view, as Kant himself did, these men sided initially with the French Revolution. You have this terrible mythology that somehow the French Revolution was nationalist. The nationalism came into existence then, which is just one of the most illiterate statements. They may be talking about the modern state, but just everyone living within the borders of that state is not a nation. A nation, of course, is an ethnic group, a language, a religious background, a shared history, not just people who happen to be living there at the time. But Kant also dealt with international politics. And Kant also realized how powerful debt was becoming. Debt was a weapon of usury. in order for states to wage war, and of course, you know, this is in the midst of Napoleon, Britain, Germany before unification, states wage war only through contracting huge debt. So any government has to, at any given moment, decide whether it wants to maintain and pay down its debt and other obligations, or to make war. So Kant's rather naive conclusion was that eventually, especially as armies get more and more technologically advanced, peace is going to have to be a basic necessity. And Fichte, of course, as pretty much everyone else, thought that that was quite naive, although there was a fundamental truth to it all. For Fichte, and this German reaction to British empiricism and imperialism, is that it's the British version of commerce, liberalism, that leads to war. And I want to quote Fichte from this book. I'm going to a bit at length, and I'm actually taking this straight from Jones's book. This is his translation, by the way, because he is fluent in German, unlike me. He's talking about Britain and the commercial mind. And he's talking about England's dominance as the world's preeminent power. And he says, it's been an endless war of all who engage in commerce against everyone else in what amounts to a war between buyers and sellers. And this war becomes more intense and more unjust and more dangerous in its consequences. The more the world's population increases, the more the commercial state increases in size because of acquisition and as the production of goods and services increases. What took place in the simple life of nations without great injustice or oppression was transformed in the light of increased need into the most flagrant injustice and a source of misery. The buyer seeks to drive down prices of the producer. As a result, he demands freedom of trade, which is to say, the freedom for the seller to steal his markets, destroy his ability to sell, and out of need to drive him, so sell his wares less than the cost that it takes to produce them. Therefore, he promotes competition among manufacturers so that the manufacturer, because of the difficulty he encounters in selling his products, and as a result, the worker is impoverished, and industrious families perish for want or immigrate to get away from an unjust nation. The buyer doesn't get what he hoped for. He is cheated. And more often than not, the net result of shoddy workmanship is pure loss of the public energy and time and the products which are so shoddily made. No one is guaranteed any continuity in his condition. The continuity of the work, which should be guaranteed because everyone wants to be free to destroy everyone else. Fichte is clearly pointing his finger at Britain. The situation with the gold standard is something he took very seriously. In his work in 1800 called The Closed Commercial State is meant to be a rather eccentric antidote to the mentality of the Newtonian universe of Adam Smith. Russia was included in this to some extent, but Prussia and France were building coalition against Britain's naval supremacy. And most of you know the history of the Napoleonic Wars. Remember, this is in 1800 he's writing all of this. But it's England's capitalism, which leads to imperialism, as he just said there, is responsible for the wars that have been convulsing Europe. And it's because usury, rather than labor or production, is what's ruling in London. Early on, those like Fichte were arguing for some variation of German unification in order to make war on this Hobbesian competition, the war of all against all. And Germany is in an intellectual position. And we all know how this wound up 100 years later. Fichte, early on, is cognizant of the race to the bottom. The problem with the gold standard, keeping rates high, and, of course, wages very low, because there's always going to be a shortage of paper when things take off. The money is simply not going to be there, and yet workers who are doing much better, more productive, are still going to have to borrow to make ends meet at ridiculously high rates, despite the fact that even better and better products, more efficiently made, are selling for less and less. The only people who benefit are those who are capable of charging these interest rates on loans. Fichte is, though an Enlightenment man himself, and this, Herder, roughly around this same time, began to realize that Germany was in a particularly good position to do battle with the Western Enlightenment in the 19th century. Russia was in the exact same position. Falling for the British alliance a century later is a different matter. Getting Russia and Germany to destroy themselves was the British mission from day one. It's right in British law that the British Navy has to be larger than any two other navies, no matter how much money they had to spend, because despite this, the market and the gold standard being self-governing, self-regulating, it was nothing of the kind. And constant expenditures, and of course, we won't get into this today, but the famines in Ireland, of which there were many in the middle of the 19th century, are the flip side of the wealth building in the big cities in Britain. Now, I mentioned the concept of time and space with Immanuel Kant for a good reason. And that is that epistemological conception was then transferred to the state rather than the person. It's the state that creates its own time and space, just like our minds do, where we get the synthetic a priori. It creates a nation out of what Kant would call a manifold. Manifold is the individual perceptions we come across every day. It creates a unity out of the manifold of tribes and personalities. It's the state that creates individuals, not the reverse. Of course, in Britain, the Enlightenment in general saw the social contract and this consent nonsense, where individuals somehow in a state of nature create the state. And there's, that's extremely difficult to defend. That was simply the Whig aristocracy and oligarchy in Britain projecting its own interests onto history, which is essentially what British empiricism comes down to, what British physics comes down to. The connection between the wealth of nations, Locke's work on epistemology and human understanding, and the Principia of Newton all come together as this, meaningless, mechanistic, forceful, it's actually based on force, universe, where there is no real purpose except what powerful people may give it. Of course, Darwin was the apogee of that. In between Smith and Darwin was Malthus, who clearly took the famines in Ireland, he took a very different view. Those of you who know the population issues with Malthus is, where this kind of death and starvation is a good thing because they simply aren't good enough. They haven't adjusted to the to those who are more industrious. The state in German thinking, Fichte and otherwise, isn't merely the way we think of it in terms of just institutions, armies, police forces, the IRS. Those are the crudest manifestations of the state. No, the state is not just the ethnos, the nation that comes from it, but also, of course, the external forms of power. But they're not really alien if they're connected with the ethnic group that helps create it. So the state, just like Kant and Fichte, thought of the mind as simply not being a passive stage where our perceptions kind of go by and then we have to kind of cobble together experience from it, which means that there's no universal truths. Our morals are just what we're raised with. It's all nothing but sentiment. No, the state, in fact, creates who and what we are. And that's why the German idealistic thing coming from Kant is extremely important. Just like our minds aren't passive, the state isn't passive. Individuals don't create the state, it's the other way around. And from this, we have the well-known school of German Romanticism, which was not, as you know, most writers of history will tell you, is just subjective emotion and feeling. It was nothing of the kind. It just posited a mind that was not passive. It was as much active in producing what was around it as receptive to what was around it. But since we're all, our minds are all structured and its fundamentals the same, it's not merely a subjective element of this. Now, what Kant eventually did, coming from that basic metaphysics, was to try to apply that to morality. And from that, he created the concept of autonomy. It isn't freedom in the vulgar sense, which is something that, you know, Fichte, the German romantics, wanted nothing to do with. Duty made more sense, because the will by itself, just the human will abstractly, is universal. It doesn't have any limit. And from that, he deduces the concept that the only things that a free will can actually will freely and autonomously are things that themselves are universal. An action can be judged whether or not it can be made into a universal law. So if you lie to someone over something very important, you think to yourself, well, what would happen if everyone did this? Well, that you could hardly conceive of it, because you couldn't talk to anybody then. Society would immediately come to a stop and collapse. In other words, to believe that lying could be universalized is the total destruction of society. It's a contradiction. Because the basic function of a society, at least, you know, communication, is to speak the truth. That's the whole purpose of this. Now, of course, in the usurious mentality, the capitalist mentality, is to manipulate people. We know what advertising does. Jones actually does a very good job in explaining that advertising derives in the 18th century, even before, from the Jewish areas that were driving down prices, shoddy goods, and the average person simply didn't really understand. Silk and cloth, everything else at a much lower price, but also a much lower quality. And the only way they could really push that is if they advertised. But prior to that, the guild system, advertising was out of the question. And Immanuel Kant was iffy about Britain. He was a revolutionary, despite what his work eventually did. And so the closed commercial state of Fichte is a salvo against Kant's support of British liberalism. He did consider himself a man of the Enlightenment, but it's hard to withdraw, even with the exception of Herder, it's tough to withdraw people like Fichte from the Enlightenment. Ultimately, what Fichte did is apply Rousseau and the general will to economics. What makes him significant is that he is a very a relatively early figure of a putting together a nationalist economics on a strong metaphysical and epistemological foundation. Now, the other thing that made Kant extremely important, after the Reformation, and the Reformation ultimately became capitalism, because the Reformation, in giving the state this tremendous power, and the monastery lands, church lands, these huge amounts of land and buildings being confiscated, not to mention the rejection of works, this created the surplus needed for the commercial society to take off. There could be no capitalism. There could be no modern capitalism without the Reformation. It was the intellectual foundation of it. Now, in reality, modern capitalism comes from the decay of the Italian city-states. That's true. So it's a degenerate Catholicism rather than the Reformation. But the Reformation was able to take advantage of it and put it on a new footing, which then eventually leads to this tremendous increase in commercial life after the expulsion of the monks and the stealing of a ridiculous amount of monastery church lands worth a fortune, and created the first markets in land, and eventually, you know, the capitalist mentality on a new foundation. It had existed before, however, but the Reformation eventually came to justify it. But afterwards, after the Reformation, Europe seemed to be split between René Descartes on the one hand and Thomas Hobbes on the other. And this so-called empiricism versus rationalism argument was settled by Immanuel Kant. And nothing in philosophy was ever the same again. Now, the state, if it is anything in Fichte's mind, if it can function at all, especially since it's national at its foundation, it's based on the common good. Therefore, the profit of the few could never be justified as any kind of policy. Because it isn't merely the profit of a few, it's the creation then of an institution that controls the economy from there on in. Market economics leads to oligarchy. And of course, it also leads, whether they like it or not, to the growth of the state. There was a clash at the same time between the goods of political cooperation on the one hand and economic competition on the other. Those two things were, these were contradictory. And it got worse, of course, when Adam Smith wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, because it ended up eliminating the need for morals at all. Now, he argues, of course, Smith argues that morals are just from socialization and sentiment. And the judge that he puts out is something called the impartial spectator. Probably one of the worst foundations for a moral theory imaginable. But of course, everyone's going to just project their own point of view onto this impartial spectator. Kant had this conception of universal duty, which was well founded. Slightly before that, you had the impartial spectator. So you had a moral standard that was completely subjective, because there was no objective ground to it, as well as totally external. So it had the worst of both worlds. And this became the foundation of social engineering. Because this is how the British empiricist and the nominalist mind went. Mankind has no nature. There is no such thing as human nature. There's no such thing as natural law. And of course, there's no such thing as universal truths from which we can deduce natural law. That means man is nothing more than the sum of his experiences. Now, because the mind has no access to any immutable truth whatsoever, the world has to be created. It has to be cobbled together, so to speak, from our disjointed perceptions. Which means if you change the perceptions, you change the man. There is no objective ground for any of this. The closest Adam Smith comes, not just to the invisible hand, but also the impartial spectator. The impartial spectator is someone who stands, and we say, you know, society wants us to do X. Well, that's the impartial spectator. It's a useless theory when you have a divided society that is divided on fundamental issues. And that's where social engineering comes from. If ethnic cleansing doesn't work, you have philosophers attached to the army, which is exactly what you had in Scotland in the Jacobite risings. You had numerous philosophers going in and setting up schools right by military camps after the defeat of the Jacobites, which is a horrible defeat. The victory of, you know, the gold and usury as a result of it. This is what education was to them, based on this form of social engineering. Again, why not just Kant, but Fichte, Herder, and Hegel were so extremely important. This was the continental reaction to British supremacy, not just, you know, economically and politically, but now also intellectually. So people like Malthus and even David Ricardo, the foundational doctrines of British capitalism, you know, the official British capitalism, they were not, even Darwin later, Spencer, they were not shy in saying capitalism has to exist with suffering. Suffering is always going to be a part of the order. You're going to have starvation, you're going to have potato famines, you can have all of it, but because of the progress that it engenders, it's worth it. Remember, the invisible hand was not nice. There was no conception of morality. People simply sought their self-interest, and eventually it's going to work out, because that's how markets work. Unfortunately, it isn't how markets work, especially when private property was a thing of the past. Capitalism was built on the theft of property from the peasantry. That the English dominance, and even Napoleon, to some extent, can be explained through English dominance, creating the continental system, leading to constant war, plunder, and misery, and ultimately despair. For Fichte, property was the foundation. You can't talk to me about, you know, synthetic priorities. You can't talk about the ego projecting the world from itself unless there's property, unless there's an absolute minimum that you have in order to function intellectually. The common good demands, according to Fichte, that the state guarantees the right to work. Having millions of able-bodied and skilled men idle through unemployment is ridiculous. It's contradictory. It doesn't make any sense. It does nothing but harm the wealth of the nation. But when usury distorts it, when rents distort it, how they define wealth changes over time. Capitalism and capital itself will destroy the state. At an absolute minimum, it will render the state nothing but a bodyguard to capital. Public policy will pretend to be based on universal considerations, but in fact, the only thing it really does is promote the interests of the lender class or the usurer class. Because capitalism exploits labor, because the entire market conception is to get a high-quality product as cheaply as humanly possible, that's going to apply to labor as well. And they'll use the state interference in the economy to smash any labor unions or anybody who will try to rectify that problem. I uploaded my lengthy paper on Karl Marx to Patreon. And in it, I explain precisely what he meant by exploitation, and it is inherent in the labor market. It's a race to the bottom, and if you posit a world that's based on competition, then you're just simply following the natural order by trying to squeeze as much as you possibly can out of your workers and pay them the absolute minimum you can get away with. It creates insecurity. No one can be secure when the market can change tomorrow. This dependency is not rational, and it doesn't make any sense. And you can't talk about independence, whether it be an individual or a nation, if you're totally dependent on the market. Hence the first word here, the closed commercial state. No contract is valid. You understand how all this comes from the new objective foundation of things and what the nation is. Contracts are only valid if they're based on the security and on securing the rights of labor to the products that it creates. Marx didn't start talking about this until a generation later, and these guys were long talking about the nature of exploitation. But it also means that immigration has to be tightly controlled. You have to have a strongly homogenous population. There has to be a high level of trust in order for any of this to work. It's both the cause of and the effect of these kind of policies. Borders have to be closed. The problem with Fichte is that as he gets deeper into this explanation of what the closed commercial state is, it ends up being a very early conception of central planning. The only place where trade, and I'm talking about foreign trade, can ever be is in the hands of the state. Ultimately, the goal is self-sufficiency or autarky. Let me quote him again here, talking about, you know, the nature of property in the nationalist system. Property is based on activity and work, not necessarily absolute possession. Fichte says, my theory is that the first and original possession is the exclusive right to a clearly defined free activity. And it comes down to the right to work. He says, what can the state give him in addition to this? Obviously, only the guarantee that he will always find work or a market for his wares. It is only through this assurance that the state binds him to herself. If the state doesn't give this guarantee, it has no call on the allegiance of its citizens, who become semi-savages in the lap of society. Ultimately, capitalism succeeded in destroying the state, in the sense that, particularly in Britain, in America today, the state didn't think that the defending its citizens against the predations of powerful and wealthy usurers is something that it has any right to do. The state does not need to guarantee work. And if the state refuses, it shirks this responsibility, it can't demand allegiance at the same time. How ridiculous is it that labor is exploited, especially in Britain at the time, worked to death in factories, and yet your patriotic duty is to go and die in a war for this very economy, and for the benefit of those, because these wars wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the factory economy. Fichte says, any state which simply ensures that one citizen doesn't rob another without ensuring that anyone has something to steal is a nation in the sense that it possesses common laws and a legal system, but it is not a nation in the sense of being united through a commonly shared pool of material goods. So any government that will not protect and will not regulate the nature of money will end up destroying itself. And of course, he's predicting what's going to happen with Britain and, of course, later the U.S. And Fichte says, the actual result of this economic system is that the population, which ends up dividing an ever-shrinking national product among itself, starts shrinking as well, and the country begins to depopulate, according to which the individual gets more than would have gotten had not the depopulation occurred. The population emigrates and seeks refuge from poverty, which has become inescapable at home, under another piece of sky, or the government itself turns its population into a commodity and tries to get money from abroad for human exports. And we have to be very clear, this is exactly what Britain did as the potato famine came to an end. But because the state acts as almost the matrix of the individual, it brings them into being, it also has to do what a parent would do and provide the foundations of labor, socially useful labor. And of course, he's exploiting all the flaws in Adam Smith's system. If the biggest problem in capitalism is the exploitation of labor through usury, whatever, then the only way to correct it is to remove that temptation, and the state is then closed. Commerce is forcibly submitted to labor. The invisible hand is laughable in Fichte's mind, because in no way can this be said to have distributed goods evenly or even rationally. Remember, usury is not work. Rents are not work. That's the very nature of usury, is to become wealthy without working, without producing anything. In Kant's mind, it would be a blatant contradiction. Can you imagine if everyone did that? It would be absolutely impossible. But universality at all only works at the level of the nation. Yeah, a common language, a common tradition, and a common religion. There has to be a high level of social trust for this to make any sense. Without social trust, you don't have a country at all. You have a labor pool, if anything. The state, in order to function at all as a state and have any claim to being a family, it has to be able to provide work. It has to be able to provide sustenance at an absolute minimum level. You can't want the invisible hand, good fortune, and hitting the market just right or something like that. That somehow is the key to success. It isn't. You know, the lottery mentality. If the state abandons its working class to nothing more than chance, is what we're talking about here, so gambling allegedly, ultimately gambling, it will give them nothing. And Fichte says that capitalism has led not just to the denigration of the economy, but the absolute repression of the population in their moral state. The citizenry, and I'm quoting him here, deprived of all laws as well as rights, without rules or guarantees, they're half savages in the bosom of society. Because of the complete insecurity in which they find themselves, they will cheat and steal from those who cheat and steal from them in turn, as soon as they are the stronger. And in all of this, they do nothing beyond their most perfect right. Yeah, you know, Fichte will talk about a social contract, but in order for it to be valid, any contract at all, has to be based on production and the fact that things like the market can't be in charge of how much socially useful labor is worth. And of course, he's referring to the gold standard because his closed state doesn't has foreign trade only in the state itself. Private citizens are not allowed to engage in foreign trade. It doesn't have any need for gold. And one of his big solutions is paper money. Paper money doesn't require the so-called discipline, which is not really discipline, of gold. Gold, if anything, was a pretext to keep rates high and wages continually lower. Let me quote Fichte one more time. The government needs to count the fact that a certain amount of goods need to come into circulation in order to ensure the citizens their ability to maintain their ongoing enjoyment of their usual needs. How can the state count on the contribution of foreigners to meet these needs when they're not under the state's dominion? The state has to then set prices and guarantee them. But how can they do that among foreigners, whose prices they can't set? And this is why free international trade for Fichte is such a disaster. If the state has the responsibility for the economic well-being of its citizens, this isn't just some passive defense of what we call economic liberty. How is a citizen free if his neighbor can have everything and he has nothing? Having nothing to do with work, having nothing to do, because usury is the very opposite of work. Fichte says it's a true goal of the state to help every member of the human race. In order to keep them in existence, the commerce of the state has to be regulated in the way that we have specified. That means that the uncontrollable influence of the foreigner has to be eliminated, and that means that the rational state is synonymous with the closed commercial state, every bit as much as it is closed realm when it comes to laws and individuals. Every living person is either a citizen or he's not. Fichte stresses that the common good is not the same as abstract freedom. English free trade did not solve the problem of warfare. And yet, the academic world in America will tell you otherwise. Democracies, free market democracies, don't go to war against each other. And yet, the naivete there is extraordinary. If trade caused war, then the Germans will do the opposite. It will keep trade locally, and any foreign trade will be done only out of absolute necessity and in the hands of the state. The only way, and I'm quoting him again here, the only way to insulate property relations from the pressures of international power politics and expose them to greater considerations of justice was to construct a largely self-sufficient national economy. He makes a connection between economics and politics. The state closes its borders and puts tight controls over internal trade, commerce, in the same way that it closed off its borders to give its legal system dominion over its own political process and its own language and according to its own tradition. If there is to be foreign trade, only the state can do that. This is supposed to be a redefinition of prosperity. He says prosperity should be the prosperity of the nation, not of a few individuals whose riches are the most obvious sign of and the basic reason for the highest maladies of the nation. And the Reformation, and this you know, comes up in later work, brought in a system ultimately where the wealthy engage in economic warfare against their own citizens. And because of this, Fichte says, hatred towards the government will grow. And when the state, the banks are seen to be on the same side as the wealthy and powerful who repress them or oppress them, there is soon is a war against the government, a hatred of the government, which is carried on through deception. Everything from cheating on taxes on down. You have smuggling, the systems of fraud. Cheating the government ceases to be a something to be avoided, and it becomes praiseworthy, a romantic act of rebellion. It's a fight against a common enemy. And someone who doesn't go along with this can't continue to function. So what does the government do? It has recourse to much harsher measures, attacking the embittered members of itself as well as its own citizens. No society is secure that has to surveil everything. And yet when it's done for the sake of the common good, Fichte permits it. He sees the international trading system then, and I'm sure he'd say the same thing now, as anarchy and chaos and warfare. So he says he has to close off all commerce with foreigners. And from then on, start to create an isolated commercial body, just as it has already created an isolated juridical and political body. The first closing is accomplished. Everything else follows easily. Controlling the money supply is one of the key ways that this is done. He was well aware, as I've said before, and I had to talk about this with the gold standard. Because private citizens can't engage in foreign trade, they don't need gold, and therefore a pure fiat currency is based, again, not on private bankers, but on the state and guaranteed by the productive capacity of the state. But the problem with Fichte is that this gets more and more utopian as you read it. I reread it since I read Jones. I read it in grad school, kind of forgot about it. But it's he starts getting utopian. Remember, this is in 1800. The state probably couldn't do much of what he wanted it to do, because ultimately he argues for central planning of everything. The state determines the prices of goods and how much is produced. Otherwise, you have a market and you have dependency. It's easy to say that he's gone too far in the other direction. But let me put it like this. The closed commercial state, or any rational state in Fichte's mind, it can only make good on the social contract, which he does accept. And again, this is how he applies Rousseau and the general will to economics. The social contract, as I've said, can only be manifest in guaranteeing productive labor for everyone who's capable of it. Well, it can't do that unless it completely controls the economy, which you have to do if the market doesn't function, the market in the British sense of the word. Well, how can it control the economy? It could guarantee itself control over the economy only by the total control over the money supply. And they are cutting out usurers in this respect. But it could only ensure that it controls its own money supply if it closes off its borders and confiscate everyone's gold. And, you know, it's you know, like Hitler did later, you know, his currency was based on, you know, gold was a minuscule part of the entire thing. You know, the closed commercial state doesn't really need gold except in the center. And if they have no need of gold, that means the state can make money on anything it wants. And he says that creating a national money, I mean, there's a reason that there's pictures of heroes on money, because it creates fraternity as well as manifesting it. International money, gold, ruins national solidarity or any solidarity whatsoever. National money is necessary for national solidarity, because possessing gold, which, you know, the international currency at the time, ends up with a set of interests that make it that he has more in common with foreigners who also have precious metals and the power that comes with it than his own people. The concept of dependency in international relations is very important. And it posits, among other things, that in the third world, you have this group of oligarchs who have far more in common with the Americans or the British or the Japanese than they have with their own people. They don't know their own people. We've talked about this when it comes to the color revolution. This is exactly who's engaging in color revolutions. They don't have, their connection is with the West. They're educated there. Their money is there. Their income is in dollars. Yeah, they may have a Russian or a Hispanic name, but that's about where it ends. These people are far more comfortable with foreigners in the same class as a lower class of their own people. And this is what this is why the ethnic principle is so powerful and fictive. You can't create this, you know, Darwinian illusion that I'm where I am because I'm superior, that I've adapted, that I'm quicker on my feet than everybody else, and therefore I deserve what I have. But this is exactly what Darwin said. Darwin was very economic. In fact, it was Malthus himself that Darwin says, right in his autobiography, gave him the concept of survival of the fittest. It came straight from economics. And so for Fichte's point of view, if the state doesn't regulate or even ban trade with gold, privately owned gold, and all that represents, if he can trade just as easily with foreigners as with his fellow citizens, then he will gravitate towards those of his own class that are foreigners. His own people will seem strangers, and the stranger they are, the easier it'll be to exploit them. He's not a fellow citizen anymore. The anarchy of trade has to end. Fichte said that the state could extract itself from this commercial rivalry by seizing control of the monetary system. Complete control over the money supply would enable the state to nationalize all foreign trade and give it the resources to begin increasing its economic independence. This is why Fichte ultimately advocates the full confiscation of gold and silver currency from circulation, of course, replacing it with paper. The value of this paper is based on the nation and the state that represents it. Those who didn't want to give it over were certainly free to emigrate. And let me quote Jones here. And you know, as great as Fichte was in so many areas, let me quote E. Michael Jones. As Fichte gets into the details of how the closure of the state is to be carried out, the state becomes more intrusive and the plan progressively more utopian. To close the commercial state, government agents would purchase all foreign goods available through the state. The state would then become the intermediary in all commercial transactions with foreigners. It would then determine the prices of all domestic goods independently of their price in the world market. The state would fund all this activity from the Weltgeld, which had confiscated when the national money had been introduced. That confiscated money would also fund centrally planned industrialization. Again, here, you know, the state can only fulfill its role as a state in a true familial way if it guaranteed useful work. Again, It can only do this if it had full control over everything. In order for Fichte's plan to work out, the state had to become omnipresent, omnicompetent. It would need to determine how many artisans are there, how many farmers are there. And the goal was a good one, you know, bringing in concepts of morality and justice, which Adam Smith had banished. The invisible hand had banished from economic life. And I'm going to end here by quoting Fichte one last time. Before someone gets to decorate his house, all must have enough to eat and have a secure place to live. Everyone needs to be comfortably and warmly clothed before someone gets to dress ostentatiously. A state with agriculture is a primitive state, which needs many hands to produce food, and one which lacks a normal amount of mechanics can have no luxuries. This is not a matter of someone saying, oh, I can afford it. It's unjust that one man can afford things that aren't necessary, while at the same time his fellow citizen can't find necessities or can't afford to pay for them. The money which the one uses to pay for luxuries is not his, according to the legal code of the rational state. It's one of these situations where his intentions are good, even the foundation of the structure is good, but when you're completely used to a society being determined by market signals, whether those market signals are invented or imposed, it doesn't matter. That's what we call them. What are the alternatives? If the market inherently involves exploitation and manipulation and false advertising and, you know, everything else, repressing labor and exploitation and the rest of it, well, what do you do about it? Where do prices come from then? You know, a lot of the early communists, you know, even Fidel Castro, a few others tried to get rid of money. Pol Pot did it. And of course, that doesn't last very long. But I'll say it now. I'll conclude by saying very clearly, if you have a strong family-based, more or less homogenous population, one religion, there's very little that it can't do. Solidarity is far more important than anything else. You see what the Jews are based almost entirely on solidarity. They don't do to each other what they would do to us. There's a certain, you know, you have to kind of admire how intensely that's worked over time, very much at our expense. But as Sven Longshanks has been saying his whole career, and I will echo, that's our fault. That, you know, Christianity has allowed itself to be taken over, has allowed itself to become a prostitute for these people, actually believing the BS that diversity is our strength, knowing full well the only reason that there's diversity is so we shut up, that there's people to tell us to shut up. In a homogenous society right now, Sven Longshanks wouldn't be in prison. Using one group against another is how the usurer clans and cults stay in power. But with homogeneity and solidarity, any political system can be made to work. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I know this was kind of a tough one, but I will also see you next time. Bye-bye.